polish, dusty upholstery, stale air. He threw his suitcase onto the bottom mattress and sat down next to it. The compartment was claustrophobic, like a cell. He wondered whether Oster had managed to make contact with the British. If not, he would have to devise some fallback plan, but his nerves were too on edge to think of one at the moment. Presently he heard shouting in the distance and some cheering. Through the window he saw a man trotting backwards very quickly, holding a camera. A few seconds later, a flash lit up the platform, and the Führer's party came into view, marching quickly. At the centre was Hitler, wearing a belted brown overcoat, flanked and followed by men in SS black. He passed within 3 metres of Hartmann, staring straight ahead, his expression one of intense irritation, and disappeared out of sight. His entourage trailed after him, dozens of them, or so it seemed, and then Hartmann heard the compartment door opening. He swung round, and there was Sturmbannführer Sauer on the threshold with the SS adjutant. For an instant, he thought they had come to arrest him, but then Sauer said in a baffled voice, "Hartmann, what are you doing here?" He stood. "I have been assigned to help Dr. Schmidt with translation." "Translation will only be required in Munich." Sauer turned to the adjutant. "It's not necessary for this man to be on the Führer's train. Who authorized it?" The adjutant looked helplessly at his clipboard. "His name was added to the list." Suddenly the train lurched forwards and stopped abruptly. All three had to grab on to something to maintain their balance. Then, very slowly, the platform began to slide past the window, empty luggage trolleys, a sign reading Berlin Anhalter BHF, the line of saluting officials, a procession of images that gradually increased in velocity until the train emerged from the shadows of the station into the wide expanse of the marshalling yard, as vast as a steel prairie in the moonless September night. Chapter 5. Cleverley called a meeting of the junior private secretaries in his office at 9 p.m. sharp. They trooped in together, Leggett, Sires, Miss Watson, and stood in a line while he perched on the edge of his desk. They were braced for what Sires liked to call his staff officer visits the trenches speech. "Thank you all for your efforts today. I know how hectic it's been. Even so, I need to ask everyone to be on parade again tomorrow morning by 7:30. I want to be sure we're all here to give the PM a rousing send-off. He'll leave number 10 for the drive to Heston Aerodrome at 7:45. 2 aircraft will be making the trip to Munich." He picked up a sheaf of papers. "It's been decided that on the first plane will be the PM, Sir Horace Wilson, Lord Dunglass, and 3 officials from the Foreign Office, William Strang, Frank Ashton Watkin, and Sir William Malkin. We've also been instructed to send someone from the private office." He turned to Sires. "Cecil, I'd like it to be you." Sires' head rocked back slightly in surprise. "Really, sir?" He looked at Leggett, who promptly stared at his shoes. He felt nothing but relief. "I suggest you pack on the assumption you'll be staying for up to 3 nights. The Germans are arranging hotel rooms. On the second plane will be 2 detectives for the PM's protection, the PM's doctor, and 2 girls from the garden room. Each plane has space for 14 passengers, so if one of them develops any mechanical problem, everyone can transfer to the other." Sires raised his hand. "I appreciate the honour, sir, but wouldn't Hugh be a better choice? His German is 10 times better than mine." "I've made my decision. Leggett will stay here with Miss Watson and deal with correspondence. We have telegrams of congratulation to answer from almost every leader in the world, let alone the thousands of letters from members of the public. If we don't make a start on it soon, we'll never get on top of it. All right?" He looked along the line. "Good. Thank you all. I'll see you in the morning." Once they were back in the corridor, Sires beckoned Leggett into his office. "I'm so sorry about this, Hugh. It's absolutely bloody ridiculous." "Really, don't give it another thought. You're senior to me." "Yes, but you're the German expert. For God's sake, you were in Vienna when I was still in the Dominion's office." "Honestly, it's fine." Leggett was so touched by his concern, he felt he should try to alleviate it. "To be perfectly frank, between you and me, I'm relieved not to be going." "Why on earth wouldn't you want to go? Don't you want to see Hitler in the flesh? Something to tell the grandchildren?" "Actually, that's just it. I've already seen Hitler in the flesh. In Munich, as a matter of fact, 6 months before he came to power. And I can assure you, once was quite enough." You've never mentioned that before. What happened? Did you go to a Nazi rally? No, I didn't hear him speak. Suddenly, Leggett wished he'd never brought the subject up, but Sires was so insistent on hearing more that he couldn't really leave it at that. It was only in the street one day, outside his apartment building, to be exact. We ended up being chased off by his brown shirts. He closed his eyes briefly, as he always did whenever he thought of it. I'd only just left Oxford, so I suppose I could at least plead youth as an excuse. Anyway, enjoy Munich, assuming you get a chance to see it. He escaped into the corridor. Sires called after him. Thanks, you. I'll give your regards to the Führer. Back in his own office, Miss Watson was putting on her coat to go home. Nobody knew where she lived. Leggett guessed she must be lonely, but she rebuffed all invitations. Oh, there you are, she said irritably. I was just about to write you a note. Sir Alexander Cadogan's secretary called for you. He wants to see you right away. Workmen, lit by floodlights, were laying sandbags outside the entrance to the Foreign Office. Leggett found the sight mildly disturbing. It seemed that nobody had bothered to tell the Ministry of Works that the Sudeten crisis was supposed to be over. Cadogan's outer office was deserted, the door to his inner sanctum slightly ajar. When Leggett knocked, the permanent under-secretary appeared in person, smoking a cigarette. Ah, Leggett, come in. He was not alone. Seated on the leather sofa at the far end of the cavernous room was a man of about 50, saturnine, elegant, with a thick moustache and deep-set, staring, dark eyes. Cadogan said, "This is Colonel Mingus." He pronounced the name in the Scottish manner, Mingus. "I asked him to take a look at the documents you brought in last night. You'd better sit down." A colonel wearing a Savile Row suit in Whitehall, thought Leggett. That could only mean the Secret Intelligence Service. The armchair matched the sofa, hard, brown, scuffed, exquisitely uncomfortable. Cadogan took its twin. He reached up and turned on a tasseled standard lamp. It, too, looked as if it might have been borrowed from some baronial Scottish castle. A grimy ochre light suffused their corner of the office. "Colonel?" On the low table in front of Mingus was a thick manila folder. He opened it and took out the document that had been put through Leggett's door. "Well, the first thing to say is it's genuine, as far as we can tell." He spoke in a friendly, Etonian drawl that immediately put Leggett on his guard. "It ties in with everything we've been hearing from various opposition figures in Germany since the beginning of the summer. But this is the first time they've produced actual written evidence. I gather from Alex you have no idea why it should have come to you?"
"That's right."
"Well, they are a disparate lot, it must be said. A handful of diplomats, a landowner or two, an industrialist. Half of them don't seem to be aware of the existence of the other half. The only thing they all seem to agree on is they expect the British Empire to go to war to restore the Kaiser, or at any rate his family, which, considering we lost the best part of 1 million men getting rid of the bugger less than 20 years ago, betrays a certain political naivety, to put it mildly. They say they have support within the army, but frankly, apart from a few disaffected Prussians at the top, we are not convinced. Your chap, on the other hand, sounds as if he might be a bit more interesting."
"My chap?"
The colonel consulted his folder. "I assume the name Paul von Hartmann is not unknown to you?" So that was it. It had happened at last. The file looked intimidatingly extensive. Leggett could see no point in evasion. "Yes, of course, we were at Balliol together. He was a Rhodes Scholar. So you think he is the one who delivered the document?"
"Sent it, rather than delivered it. He's in Germany. When did you last see him?"
Leggett pretended to think. 6 years ago? The summer of 32.
You've not been in contact since?"
"No."
"Do you mind if I ask why not?"
"No specific reason. We simply drifted apart."
"Whereabouts did you last see him?"
"In Munich."
"Munich, really? Suddenly all roads seem to lead to Munich."
The colonel smiled, but his eyes bored into Leggett's.
"Do you mind if I ask what you're doing there?"
"I was on holiday, a walking holiday in Bavaria at the end of finals."
"On holiday with von Hartmann?"
"Among others."
"And you haven't communicated since? Not even a letter?"
"That's right."
"Well then, forgive me, it doesn't sound as if you drifted apart so much as had a blazing row." Leggett took his time before replying. It's true we had some political differences. In Oxford they didn't seem to matter so much, but this was Germany, in July, in the middle of a general election campaign. You couldn't escape politics at that time, especially in Munich. So your friend was a Nazi? No. If anything, he considered himself a socialist, but he was also a German nationalist. That was what led to the arguments. Cadogan cut in. A national socialist, then, but lower case, perhaps, rather than upper. You're smiling? I've said something droll? Forgive me, Sir Alex, but that is what Powell would have called a classic piece of English sophistry. For a moment he thought he might have gone too far, but then Cadogan's mouth twitched down slightly, which was his way of registering amusement. Yes, fair enough. I suppose he would have had a point. The Colonel said, Did you know that Hartmann had entered the German diplomatic service? I did hear his name mentioned in that connection, by mutual friends at Oxford. I wasn't surprised. It was always his intention. His grandfather was an ambassador under Bismarck. Did you also know he joined the Nazi Party? No, but again, it makes sense, given his belief in a greater Germany. We're sorry to have to ask you all these questions, Leggett, but a situation has arisen, and we need to understand precisely what sort of relationship you have, or had, with this particular German. He put down the folder, and it occurred to Leggett that most of it probably had nothing to do with him, and that it was merely a trick to fool him into thinking they knew more than they did. It seems your former friend Hartmann is now working with the opposition to Hitler. His position inside the Foreign Ministry has given him access to secret material which he is willing to share with us, or, more specifically, which he is willing to share with you. How do you feel about that? Surprised? But willing, in principle, to take matters further? In what sense? Cadogan said, Willing to go to Munich tomorrow and meet with your old friend? Good heavens! Leggett had not been expecting that. He's going to be in Munich? Apparently, yes. The Colonel said, One member of the German opposition whom I do take seriously has been in touch with us this evening via a secret channel to ask if we can arrange for you to travel to Munich as part of the PM's party. In return, they will try to make sure Hartmann is included in the German delegation. It appears Hartmann has another document in his possession, more important than the one you received last night. He has some mad notion of handing it to the Prime Minister personally, which obviously cannot be allowed to happen. However, he will give it to you. We'd very much like to know what it is. Therefore, we think you should go and meet him. Leggett stared at him. I'm utterly astonished. It's not without risk, warned Cadogan. Technically, at least, it will be an act of espionage on foreign soil. We wouldn't want to mislead you about that. The Colonel said, Yes, but on the other hand, it's hard to believe the Germans would seek to embarrass His Majesty's government with a spying scandal in the middle of an international conference. Are you sure about that? Cadogan shook his head. With Hitler, anything is possible. The last thing he wants to do tomorrow is sit down with the PM and Daladier. I suspect he's perfectly capable of seizing on exactly such an incident as an excuse to break off negotiations. He turned to Leggett. So you need to consider it carefully. The stakes are high. And there's another point. We think it best if the Prime Minister knows nothing about this. Do you mind if I ask why? The Colonel said, Often in these delicate matters it's better for politicians not to know the full details. You mean in case something goes wrong? No, said Cadogan. Rather because the PM is already under the most immense strain, and it's our duty as public servants to do everything we can not to add to it. Leggett made one last feeble attempt at escape. You do know that Oscar Cleverly has already told Cecil Sires that he will be travelling to Munich? That's not an issue that need concern you. Leave Cleverly to us. Absolutely, said the Colonel. I know Oscar. Both men fell silent, watching him, and Leggett had a peculiar sense of, what was it, he wondered afterwards, not of déjà vu exactly, but of inevitability, that he had always known Munich was not done with him, that however far he might travel from that place and time,
He was forever caught in its gravitational pull, and would be dragged back towards it eventually. "Of course," he said. "Of course I'll do it." By the time he got back to number 10, Sires had gone for the night. Cleverly was still working. He could see the light under his door and could hear his voice talking on the telephone. He crept past, anxious to avoid the possibility of an encounter, collected his overnight case from the corner of his office, and set off to walk home. Images he had consciously suppressed for half a decade stalked him at every step. Memories not so much of Germany, but of Oxford. As he walked past the Abbey, he sensed again the impossibly tall figure loping at his side through a damp evening along the Turl. "Night is the best time for friendship, my dear Hugh," his profile in the lamplight as he stopped to light a cigarette. Beautiful, fanatical, almost cruel, and that astonishing smile after he had exhaled, the swirling skirts of his full coat brushing the cobbles. The curious combination of his manliness — he seemed so much older and experienced than the rest of them in the boy world of Oxford — and yet a self-dramatizing defeatism, "my passionate melancholy," that was entirely adolescent, indeed verging on the comic. He had once clambered up onto the Magdalen Bridge and threatened to throw himself into the river in despair at what he said was their mad generation, until Leggett had pointed out that he would only succeed in getting himself wet and possibly catching a chill. He used to complain that he lacked the one great characteristic of the English, and that is distance, not only from one another, but from all experience. "I believe it is the secret of the English art of living." Leggett could remember every word. He reached the end of North Street, found his key, and let himself into the house. Now that the immediate crisis seemed to be over, he had half expected to find Pamela at home with the children, but when he turned on the light, he saw that the place was empty, exactly as he had left it. He set down his suitcase at the bottom of the stairs. Still wearing his coat, he went into the drawing room, picked up the telephone, and dialed the operator. It was after 10, an unsociable hour for a call, especially in the English shires, but he thought the circumstances justified it. His father-in-law answered, pedantically reciting his number. Pamela always said he had done something unspeakably boring in the city before retiring at 50, and Leggett could believe it, although he had been careful never to inquire precisely what it was. He avoided speaking to his in-laws as much as possible. Somehow the conversation always turned to money, and his lack of it. "Hello, sir. It's Hugh. Sorry to ring so late."
"Hugh!"
For once the old boy actually sounded glad to hear him.
"I must say we've been thinking about you rather a lot today. What a business it's been. Were you very much involved?"
"Oh, only on the margins, you know."
"Well, having been all the way through the last show, I can't tell you the relief at avoiding another."
He put his hand over the receiver, and Leggett heard him call out,
"Darling, it's Hugh."
He came back on the line immediately.
"You must tell me all about it. Were you in the house when the Prime Minister received the news?"
Leggett sat in an armchair and patiently described the events of the day for a couple of minutes, until he felt he had done all that filial politeness required of him.
"Anyway, sir, I can give you the full blow-by-blow the next time I see you. I just wanted a quick word with Pamela, if I might."
"Pamela?" The voice on the other end sounded suddenly confused.
"Isn't she with you?" "She left the children with us and drove back to London about 4 hours ago."
After he had hung up, "Actually, sir, don't worry. I think I can hear her at the door now." He sat and stared at the telephone for a long while. Occasionally his eyes flickered to the diary that lay beside it, a Smithson featherweight diary, bound in red morocco, gilt-edged, of the sort he bought her every Christmas. Why did she leave it lying around, except for him to pick it up, to leaf through it with his usual clumsy, nervous fingers, to find the date, to read the number, and for once, just this once, the only time he had ever done so, to call it? It rang a long time before it was answered. A man's voice, vaguely familiar, came on the line, confident, relaxed.
"Yep, hello."
Leggett pressed the receiver very hard against his ear and listened intently. He heard the sound of the sea.
"Hello," the voice repeated. "Who is this?"
And then, in the background,
distinctly enough that he suspected she might have intended it to be overheard, the voice of his wife.
"Whoever it is, tell them to go away."
Day 3. Chapter 1. The Führer's special train was unusually heavy, entirely made of welded steel. It steamed steadily southwards through the night at an average speed of 55 kilometers per hour. It did not stop. It did not even slow down. It passed through big cities such as Leipzig and smaller country towns and villages, and between them it traversed great stretches of nothingness, broken only by the occasional light of an isolated farmhouse. Sleepless, Hartmann lay in his underclothes on the top bunk, his fingers parting the blind so that he could stare into the darkness. He had the sensation of voyaging in a liner across an ocean of unmeasurable extent. The immensity was what he had never been able to convey to his Oxford friends, whose concept of their own nationality was so nicely bounded by a coast. This hard, wide, vast landscape, fertile in its genius, boundless in its possibilities, which demanded a constant effort of will and imagination to order into a modern state. It was hard to talk about such feelings without sounding mystical. Even Hugh had not understood. To the English ear, one invariably came across as a German nationalist, although what was wrong with that? The corruption of honest patriotism was one of the many things of which Hartmann would never forgive the Austrian corporal. The sound of Sauer's rhythmic, heavy breathing rose through the thin mattress. Before they had even left Berlin's city limits, the Sturmbannführer had pulled rank to insist on having the bottom bunk. Not that Hartmann had objected. It meant he was able to put his belongings into the luggage rack immediately above his head. The wide string mesh bulged under the weight of his suitcase. He had not let it out of his sight. Soon after 5 a.m, he noticed the sky at the edges beginning to turn an oyster grey. Gradually the dark crests of the wooded pine hills emerged, serrated like saw's teeth against the spreading light, while in the valleys the white mist seemed as solid as a glacier. For the next half hour, he watched as the countryside took on colour. Green and yellow meadows, red-roofed villages, white-painted wooden church spires, a turreted castle with blue shutters, beside a wide, slow river he assumed must be the Danube. When he was sure that sunrise could only be a few minutes away, he sat up and cautiously took down his suitcase. He muffled the noise of the catches one at a time with his hand, and opened the lid. He extracted the document and stuffed it under his vest. Then he put on a clean white shirt and buttoned it. He took the gun from his jacket and folded his trousers around it. Holding that in one hand, and with his shaving kit tucked under his other arm, he carefully descended the ladder. As his bare feet touched the floor of the compartment, Sauer muttered and turned over. His uniform was on a hanger at the end of his bed. He had spent a long time before he went to sleep brushing it and straightening the creases. His boots were perfectly aligned beneath it. Hartmann waited until his breathing had resumed its regular pattern, then slowly lifted the catch and slid open the door. The corridor was empty. He swayed along it towards the toilet at the back of the carriage. Once he was inside it, he drew the bolt and turned on the light. Like the sleeper compartment, it was lined in polished, light-coloured wood with modernist fittings made of stainless steel. There were tiny swastikas on the taps. There was no escaping the Führer's aesthetic, thought Hartmann, not even when one took a shit. He inspected his face in the mirror above the tiny washbasin. Disgusting. He removed his shirt and lathered his chin. He had to shave with his feet braced wide apart to steady himself against the movement of the train. When he had finished, he dried his face, then crouched on his haunches and inspected the wooden panel beneath the sink. He ran his fingers around the back until he found a gap. He pulled, and it came away easily, exposing the plumbing. He unwrapped the gun from his trousers, wedged it beneath the waste pipe, and pushed the panel back into place. 5 minutes later, he was making his way back along the corridor. Beyond the windows, an empty Autobahn ran alongside the railway track, gleaming in the early morning sunshine. He slid open the door of his compartment to discover Sauer in his underwear bent over the lower bunk. He had tipped out Hartman's suitcase and was rummaging through the contents. Hartman's jacket lay alongside it. It looked as though he had checked through that already. He didn't even bother to turn round.
"I'm sorry, Hartman. It's nothing personal. I'm sure you're a decent fella. But when a man is this close to the Führer, I'm not prepared to take any chances."
He stood and gestured to the mess on the mattress.
"There you are. You can put it all back now."
"Don't you want to give me a full body search while you're at it?" Hartman raised his hands.
"That won't be necessary."
He clapped Hartman on the shoulder.
"Come on, man, don't look so offended. I've apologized. You know as well as I do the Foreign Ministry is rotten with reaction. What is it that Goering says about diplomats? That you sharpen your pencils all morning and take tea all afternoon?"
Hartman pretended to be offended, then nodded curtly.
"You're right. I admire your vigilance." "Excellent. Wait for me while I shave, and then we'll go for breakfast."
He picked up his uniform and boots and went out into the corridor. After he had gone, Hartman tugged the document out from under his vest. His hands were shaking. He placed it in the suitcase. Surely he wouldn't search it again. Or perhaps he would. He imagined Sauer at that very moment, on his knees, inspecting behind the wash basin. He folded his clothes back into the case, closed the catches, and heaved it up into the luggage rack. By the time he had finished dressing and had regained his composure, there was a clump of boots in the corridor. The door opened, and there was Sauer, once more clad in his SS uniform, looking as if he had just stepped off the parade ground. He threw his sponge bag onto his bed.
"Let's go."
They had to pass through another sleeper carriage to reach the dining car. The train was all awake by now. Men, half-dressed or still in underpants, were squeezing past one another in the narrow corridor and queuing outside the toilets. There was a smell of sweat and cigarettes, a changing room atmosphere, laughter as the train jolted and they were thrown together. Sauer exchanged heils with a couple of SS comrades. He opened the connecting door, and Hartman followed, stepping over the metal platform that made a junction into the restaurant car. Here it was all much quieter. White linen tablecloths, the smell of coffee, the chink of cutlery on china, a waiter wheeling a trolley laden with food. At the far end of the carriage, an army general, in a field grey uniform with red collar tabs, was talking to a trio of officers. Sauer noticed Hartman staring at him.
"That's General Keitel," he said. "Chief of the Wehrmacht Supreme Command. He's breakfasting with the Führer's military adjutants." "What's a general doing at a peace conference?"
"Perhaps it may not turn out to be a peace conference," Sauer winked.
They took a nearby table for two. Hartman sat with his back to the engine. The carriage darkened as they passed beneath a station canopy. On the platform, a line of waiting passengers waved. He guessed an announcement must have been made over the loudspeaker that the through train was Hitler's. Enthusiastic faces whirled past the window in a mist of steam.
"If nothing else," continued Sauer, unfolding his napkin, "the presence of General Keitel will remind those elderly gentlemen from London and Paris that a single word from the Führer is all it will require for the army to cross the Czech frontier."
"I thought Mussolini had put a stop to mobilization."
"The Duce will be joining the train for the final part of the journey to Munich. Who knows what will happen when the leaders of fascism confer? Perhaps the Führer will persuade him to change his mind."
He beckoned to the waiter to bring them coffee. When he turned back to the table, his eyes were shining.
"Admit it, Hartman. Whatever happens, isn't there something intensely exhilarating, after all those years of national humiliation, in finally making the British and the French dance to our tune?"
"It is certainly an amazing achievement."
The man was intoxicated, thought Hartman, drunk on a little man's dreams of revenge. The waiter arrived with a tray of food, and they both filled their plates. He took a bread roll and broke it in half. He found he had no appetite, even though he couldn't remember the last time he had eaten.
"May I ask, sir, what you did before you joined the Foreign Minister's staff?"
He didn't really care. He was just making conversation.
"I worked in the office of the Reichsführer SS."
"And before that?"
"Before the party came to power, you mean. I sold automobiles in Essen."
He was eating a hard-boiled egg. A piece of yolk was stuck to his chin.
Suddenly his face twisted into a sneer. "Oh, I can see what you're thinking, Hartman. What a vulgar fellow, a car salesman, and now he fancies himself as a second Bismarck. But we have done something your kind never managed. We have made Germany great again."
"Actually," said Hartman mildly, "I was thinking you have egg on your chin."
The Tsar put down his knife and fork and wiped his mouth with his napkin. His face had turned red. It was a mistake to have teased him, thought Hartman. He would never forgive him. And at some point in the future, maybe later that day, or next month, or next year, revenge would be exacted. The meal resumed in silence.
"Herr von Hartman?"
Hartman looked round. A large man, portly in a double-breasted suit, was looming over him. His domed head was bald, his thin, dark hair combed back and plastered into place behind his ears with oil. He was sweating.
"Dr. Schmidt."
Hartman put down his napkin and stood.
"Forgive me for disturbing your meal, Sturmbannführer."
The Foreign Ministry's chief interpreter bowed towards Tsar.
"We have received the overnight English-language press summary, and I wondered if I could trouble you, Hartman."
"Of course. Excuse me, sire."
Hartman followed Schmidt the length of the dining car, past General Keitel's table and into the next carriage. Along the left-hand side were desks, typewriters, filing cabinets. On the right, the windows were blacked out. Wehrmacht signals officers, wearing headphones, faced one another across tables stacked with shortwave radio equipment. It wasn't so much a train as a mobile command post. It struck Hartman that the original plan must have been for Hitler to travel in it to the Czech frontier. Schmidt said,
"The Führer expects to see a press summary as soon as he gets up. 2 pages will be sufficient. Concentrate on the headlines and the editorial view. Get one of the men to type it for you."
He deposited a sheaf of handwritten English transcripts on a desk and hurried away. Hartman sat. It was a relief to have something to do. He shuffled through the dozens of quotations, pulling out the most interesting, sorting them according to the influence of the publication. He found a pencil and began to write.
"The London Times praises Chamberlain for his indomitable resolution. The New York Times, the sense of relief felt around the world. The Manchester Guardian, for the first time in weeks we seem to turn towards the light."
The tone was the same, regardless of the political line of the paper. All described the dramatic scene in the House of Commons as Chamberlain read out the Führer's message. Within minutes and even seconds, the message of hope was being hailed by millions whose lives a moment before seemed to hang upon the pull of a trigger. The British Prime Minister was the hero of the world. When he had finished his translations, he was directed by the unit commander to an army corporal. Hartman lit a cigarette, stood behind the corporal's shoulder and dictated. The machine was a special typewriter reserved for documents that went direct to the Führer, its typeface almost a centimetre high. His digest came out at exactly 2 pages. As the corporal wound it out of the typewriter, an SS adjutant appeared at the far end of the carriage. He looked harassed.
"Where is the foreign press summary?"
Hartman waved the pages.
"I have it here."
"Thank God! Follow me!"
As the adjutant opened the door, he pointed to Hartman's cigarette.
"No smoking beyond this point."
They entered a vestibule. An SS sentry saluted. The adjutant opened the door onto a panelled conference room with a long, polished table and seats for 20. The adjutant indicated that Hartman should go ahead of him.
"Is this your first time?"
"Yes."
"Salute. Look him in the eye. Don't speak unless he speaks to you."
They had reached the end of the carriage and passed through into the vestibule of the next. Another sentry. The adjutant patted Hartman on the back.
"You'll be fine."
He knocked lightly on the door and opened it.
"The foreign press summary, my Führer."
Hartman walked into the room and raised his arm.
"Heil Hitler!"
He was leaning over a table, his hands balled into fists, looking down at a set of technical drawings. He turned to glance at Hartman. He was wearing a pair of steel-rimmed spectacles. He took them off and looked past Hartman to the adjutant.
"Tell Keitel to set up the maps in here."
The familiar metallic voice. It was strange to hear it at a conversational level, and not ranting over a loudspeaker. Yes, my Führer.
He held out his hand for the press summary. And you are? Hartmann, my Führer. He took the two sheets and started reading, rocking gently up and down on the balls of his feet. Hartmann had an impression of great energy, barely suppressed. After a while, he said contemptuously, Chamberlain this, Chamberlain that, Chamberlain, Chamberlain. When he reached the bottom of the first page, he stopped and flexed his head as if he had a crick in his neck, then read aloud in a tone of intense sarcasm, Mr. Chamberlain's description of his last meeting with Herr Hitler is agreeable proof that his strong candor was rewarded with liking and respect. He turned the page back and forth. Who wrote this shit?
That is an editorial in the Times of London, I fear.
He raised his eyebrows as if he expected nothing else, and flicked over to the second page. Hartmann looked briefly around the carriage. A saloon car, armchairs, a sofa, watercolours of pastoral scenes hanging on the light-coloured wood-panelled walls. It occurred to him that the two of them had now been entirely alone for more than a minute. He inspected the fragile head, bent, oblivious, reading. If he had known, he would have brought his gun. He imagined feeling for it in his inside pocket, quickly withdrawing it, pointing the barrel, a moment of eye contact, perhaps, before he squeezed the trigger, a final look, and then the explosion of blood and tissue. He would have been reviled until the end of time. And he realized he could never have done it. The insight into his own weakness appalled him.
You speak English?
He was still reading.
Yes, my Führer. You have spent time in England?
I was at Oxford for 2 years. He looked up, stared out of the window. His expression became dreamy.
Oxford is the second oldest university in Europe, founded in the 12th century. I have often wondered what it would be like to see it. Heidelberg was founded a century later. Of course, Bologna is the oldest of them all.
The door opened and the adjutant appeared.
General Keitel, my Führer.
Keitel marched in and saluted. Behind him an army officer carried rolled-up charts.
You wish to have the maps in here, my Führer?
Yes, Keitel. Good morning. Set them up on the table. I want to show them to the Duce.
He threw the press summary onto the desk and watched as the maps were unrolled. One was of Czechoslovakia, the other of Germany. On both, the positions of military units were drawn in red. He folded his arms and stared down at them.
40 divisions to destroy the Czechs. We would have done it in a week. 10 divisions to hold the conquered territory, the remaining 30 transferred to the west to hold the frontier.
He rocked up and down again on the balls of his feet.
It would have worked. It could still work. Liking and respect, that old asshole. The train is heading in the wrong direction, Keitel.
Yes, my Führer.
The adjutant touched Hartmann on the arm and gestured to the door. As he left the compartment, he looked back for a moment. But all attention was now focused on the maps, and he saw that his existence had already been forgotten. Chapter 2 Leggett had spent the night at his club. He had arrived to discover a backgammon evening in progress. Much strong drink had been taken. Until long after midnight, the muffled noises of heavy male conversation and stupid laughter permeated the floorboards of his room. Even so, he preferred it to the silence of North Street, where he would only have lain awake, listening for the sound of Pamela's key in the latch, assuming, that is, she bothered to come home at all. On previous form, it was just as likely she would slink back a day or two later, offering some alibi which they both knew he would never endure the humiliation of checking. As the hours passed, he stared at the pattern of the streetlights on the ceiling, and thought about Oxford and Munich and his marriage, trying to disentangle the three. But however much he tried, the images remained entwined, and his methodical mind became disordered with fatigue. By morning, the skin beneath his eyes was like black crepe. In his tiredness, he shaved too closely, so that his cheeks and chin were raw, pricked with tiny pinpoints of blood. He was up too early for breakfast. The tables were still being laid. Outside, the muggy weather had broken, and it was drizzling. The air was a moist, cool gauze on his face, the traffic just beginning to build from St. James's Street. Wearing his Homburg and his Crombie, his suitcase in his hand, he trudged the shiny wet pavements down the slope towards Downing Street. Against the battleship grey sky, the barrage balloons were barely visible. The workmen had finished the wall of sandbags around the Foreign Office entrance. A line of 6 cars was drawn up from number 10 all the way back beyond number 11, pointing towards Whitehall, ready to take the Prime Minister's party to Heston Aerodrome. The policemen saluted. Inside the lobby, 3 senior Foreign Office officials stood with their suitcases at their feet, like guests waiting to check out of a hotel. He took them in at a glance. William Strang, the tall, dehydrated, broomstick-like figure, who had taken over from Wigram as head of the Central Department and had already been twice with the Prime Minister to visit Hitler, Sir William Malkin, the Foreign Office's senior legal adviser, who had also met Hitler and who looked like a reassuring family solicitor, and the bulky, slope-shouldered Frank Ashton Gwatkin, head of economic relations, who had spent much of the summer in Czechoslovakia listening to the grievances of the Sudeten Germans, and who was known, behind his back, on account of his domed head and drooping moustache, as the Walrus. Leggett thought it a curious trio to send into battle against the Nazis. What do they make of us? Strang said, "I didn't know you were coming to Munich, Leggett." "Neither did I, sir, until late last night." He heard the deference in his tone and felt a flicker of self-contempt. The youthful third secretary, the promising high flyer, always careful never to seem too full of himself.
"Well, I hope you've taken something for travel sickness. In my experience, and I'm beginning to acquire a lot of it, flying can be pretty rough."
"Oh, dear, I'm afraid I haven't. Will you excuse me for a moment?" He walked quickly towards the back of the building and found Sires in his office. His suitcase was by his desk. He said in a dull voice, "Hello, Hugh." Leggett said, "I really am most awfully sorry, Cecil. I didn't ask to go. I'd honestly prefer to stay behind in London." Sires made an effort to look unconcerned.
"My dear fellow, don't give it a second thought. I always said it ought to be you, not me. And Yvonne will be relieved."
"Well, that's very decent of you. When did you hear?"
"Cleveley told me 10 minutes ago."
"What did he say?"
"He simply said he'd changed his mind." "Is there anything more to it than that?"
"Not that I'm aware of." The lie came easily. Sires took a step closer and peered at him with concern.
"I hope you don't mind me asking, but are you all right?
You look a little rough."
"I didn't sleep much last night."
"Nervous about flying?"
"Not really." "Ever been up in a plane before?"
"No."
"Well, if it's any consolation, as I said to Yvonne this morning, being on the same flight as the Prime Minister must be about as safe as one can get."
"That's what I keep telling myself." From the corridor came the sound of voices. Leggett smiled and shook hands with Sires. "I'll see you when I get back." The Prime Minister had descended from his flat and was walking towards the entrance hall along with Mrs. Chamberlain, Horace Wilson, Lord Dunglass, and Oscar Cleveley. A pair of detectives followed, carrying the PM's luggage, including the red dispatch boxes containing his official papers. Behind them trailed 2 garden room secretaries, one a middle-aged woman Leggett didn't recognise, the other Joan. Cleverly noticed him and waited for him to catch up. They walked together. His mouth was clenched, his voice low and angry.
"I've no idea what's going on, but I have acceded, with considerable reservations, to Colonel Mingus's request to allow you to accompany the PM. You'll be in charge of his boxes, as well as dealing with anything else that comes up."
He gave him the keys to the dispatch cases.
"Make contact with the office as soon as you reach Munich."
"Yes, sir."
"I trust I don't need to emphasize the absolute necessity that you do nothing whatsoever that might imperil the success of this conference."
"Of course not, sir."
"And when this is all over, you and I will need to have a talk about the future."
"I understand." They had reached the lobby. The Prime Minister was embracing his wife. The Downing Street staff gave him a discreet round of applause. He broke away, smiled shyly, and raised his hat to them. His complexion was ruddy, his eye bright. There was no hint of tiredness. He looked as if he had just come back from the river for breakfast after landing a good salmon. The porter opened the door and he strode out into the rain. He paused to allow his photograph to be taken, and then stepped across the pavement and into the first car, where Horace Wilson was already waiting. His entourage filed out after him. Unconsciously, they had arranged themselves in order of seniority. Leggett was the last to leave. carrying the two red boxes and his own suitcase. He gave them to the driver and climbed into the fourth car, next to Alec Dunglass. The doors slammed and the convoy pulled away, out of Downing Street, into Whitehall, around Parliament Square, and south along the river. It was not at all clear to anyone, including Leggett, why Dunglass had been included in the party, except that he was a friendly face with a castle in Scotland, extensive fishing rights on the Tweed, and therefore good for the Prime Minister's morale. Miss Watson insisted that beneath his diffident manner lurked one of the cleverest politicians she had ever encountered. "He will be Prime Minister one day, Mr. Leggett, mark my words, and you will remember that I was the first to say it." But as Dunglass would in due course inherit his father's title and become the 14th Earl of Hume, and as it was inconceivable that in the modern age a premier could sit in the House of Lords, her prediction was dismissed in the private office as a folie d'amour. He had a very thin, straight smile, and a curious, tight-lipped way of speaking, as if he were practising to be a ventriloquist. After a few desultory exchanges about the rain and what the weather might be like in Munich, they lapsed into silence. Then, as they were passing through Hammersmith, he said abruptly, "Did you hear about Winston's remark to the PM at the end of his speech yesterday?" "No, what was that?" "He came up to him at the dispatch box while everyone was still cheering and said, 'I congratulate you on your good fortune. You're very lucky.'" Dunglass shook his head. "I mean, really, one can level many charges against Neville. One can argue his policy is entirely wrong, but one can hardly maintain this conference in Munich as a matter of luck. He's worked himself after death to achieve it." He gave Leggett a sidelong look. "I noticed you were joining in the applause yourself." "I shouldn't have done that. I'm supposed to be neutral, but one rather got carried away by the mood. I should think 9/10 of the country were relieved." The thin smile came again. "Yes, even the socialists were on their feet. It seems we're all appeasers now." They had left central London and were motoring into the suburbs. The dual carriageway was wide and modern, lined by pebble-dashed semis with small front gardens and privet hedges, interspersed with light industrial factories. Household names gleamed with grim cheerfulness through the pouring rain. Gillette, Beecham's Powders, Firestone Tyre and Rubber. Chamberlain must have been responsible for a lot of this development, thought Leggett, when he was Minister of Housing. The country had come through the Depression and was prosperous again. As they drove through Austerlitz, he noticed that people were starting to wave as they passed. A few at first, mostly mothers taking their children to school, but gradually they became more numerous until, when the convoy slowed to turn off right towards Heston, he saw that drivers had pulled over on both sides of the Great West Road and were standing beside their cars. "Neville's people," murmured Dunglass without moving his lips. At the entrance of the aerodrome they came to a halt. Spectators blocked the road. Beyond the chain-link fence and white buildings, Leggett could see a pair of large planes drawn up on the grass at the edge of the concrete apron, lit by the lights of the newsreel crews, surrounded by a tightly packed crowd of several hundred. Their umbrellas were up. From a distance they looked like a bulbous black fungus. The car moved forwards again, past saluting policemen, through the gate, and then in a wide sweep around the back of the terminal and hangar, and onto the airfield where the convoy halted. A policeman opened the rear passenger door of the lead car, and the Prime Minister emerged to cheers. Dunglass sighed.
"Well, I suppose this is it."
He and Leggett climbed out. They collected their suitcases and the red boxes. Leggett carried one, Dunglass insisted on taking the other, and set off towards the plains. The rain had stopped. The umbrellas were being furled. As they came closer, Leggett recognised the tall figure of Lord Halifax in his bowler hat, and then, to his amazement, Sir John Simon, Sam Hoare, and the rest of the cabinet. He said to Dunglass,
"Was this in the schedule?"
"No, it's a surprise. It was the Chancellor's idea. I was sworn to secrecy. It seems that suddenly they all want to share his limelight. Even Duff."
The Prime Minister went around shaking hands with his colleagues. The crowd jostled forwards, pressing against the line of policemen for a better view. Reporters, airport workers in overalls, local people, schoolboys, a mother with a baby in her arms. The newsreel camera swung to follow Chamberlain's progress. He was grinning broadly, waving his hat, childish in his delight.
Finally, he stood in front of the cluster of microphones.
"When I was a little boy,"
he began, and paused as those who were still talking were shushed into silence,
"I used to repeat, 'If at first you don't succeed, try, try, try again.' That's what I'm doing."
He had a small piece of paper in his hand and glanced down at it briefly, reminding himself of the line he had prepared, then looked up again.
"When I come back, I hope I may be able to say, as Hotspur says in Henry IV, out of this nettle, danger, we pluck this flower, safety."
He nodded emphatically. The crowd cheered. He smiled and waved his hat again, milking every last drop of acclaim, then turned towards his plane. Leggett moved forward with Dunglass. They gave their suitcases to the aircrew, who were loading the luggage into the belly of the aircraft. Leggett kept possession of the red boxes. The Prime Minister shook hands with Halifax and mounted the three metal steps into the back of the plane. He ducked out of sight, then re-emerged for one last round of cheering before vanishing for good. Wilson scuttled up next, followed by Strang, Malkin and Ashton Gwatkin. Leggett stood aside to let Dunglass go ahead of him. Close up, the plane seemed smaller and more fragile than it had at a distance, only about 40 feet long. He thought one had to admire the Prime Minister's nerve. When he had first flown to see Hitler, he hadn't even wanted to tell him he was coming until he was in the air, so that the dictator couldn't refuse to meet him. Standing on the bottom step, looking out at the enthusiastic faces, he felt suddenly intrepid himself, a pioneer. He stooped to pass through the low door. Inside the cabin were 14 seats, 7 on either side, with an aisle between them and a door at the far end to the cockpit. The nose of the plane was tilted 5 or 6 feet higher than the tail. There was a noticeable slope. It felt small and oddly intimate. The Prime Minister was already in his place at the front, on the left, with Wilson to his right. Leggett hoisted the red boxes into the wire luggage rack, removed his coat and hat, and stowed them alongside. He took the right-hand seat at the back so that he could see the Prime Minister in case he was needed. A man in a pilot's uniform was the last to board. He locked the door after him and walked to the front of the plane.
"Prime Minister, gentlemen, welcome. My name is Commander Robinson. I'm your pilot. This is a Lockheed Electra, operated by British Airways. We shall be flying at an altitude of 7,000 feet, at a maximum speed of 250 miles an hour. Our flying time to Munich is approximately 3 hours. Would you please fasten your safety belts? It may get a little bumpy, so I suggest you keep them fastened unless you need to move around the cabin."
He went into the cockpit and took the seat next to the co-pilot. Through the open door, Leggett could see his hand reaching across the instrument panel, flicking switches. One of the engines stuttered into life, then the other. The noise increased. The cabin began to shake. The notes seemed to climb a musical scale from bass to treble until it was subsumed into a single, deafening, sawing noise, and the plane lurched forwards onto the grass airfield. They bumped their way over the rough ground for a minute or two, raindrops scudding across the windows, then turned and stopped. Leggett fastened his seatbelt. He looked across at the terminal building. Beyond it were white factory chimneys. Columns of smoke rose almost vertically. There was not much wind. That must be good. He felt quite calm. "I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above." Perhaps Yeats would have been a more appropriate poet for the Prime Minister to quote than Shakespeare. The engines became much louder, and suddenly the Lockheed Electra began to accelerate across the grass. Leggett gripped the armrests as the plane raced past the terminal, yet still they remained firmly earthbound. Then, just as he thought they were bound to crash into the fence at the end of the airfield, the bottom of his stomach seemed to fall away, and the cabin tilted upwards even more sharply, pressing him back in his seat. The propellers clawed at the air, hauling them into the sky. Slowly they banked, and the landscape slid past the window, green fields, red roofs, grey streets. He looked down at the Great West Road a couple of 100 feet below, at the semi-detached houses and the cars still drawn up with their drivers beside them, and he saw that in almost every garden people had come out and were craning their heads to the sky and waving, hundreds of them, waving with both arms crossed above their heads in frantic farewell, and then they jutted up into the base of the low cloud, and the scene flickered out of sight.
After a few minutes of climbing steeply through thick grey mist, they broke free into a burst of sunshine and blueness more beautiful than anything Leggett had imagined. A crystal-white vista of peaks and ravines and waterfalls carved out of cloud stretched into the distance. It reminded him of the Bavarian Alps, but purer and unsullied by humanity. The plane levelled off. He unfastened his seatbelt and made his way unsteadily towards the front.
"Excuse me, Prime Minister, I just wanted to let you know I have your boxes whenever you need them."
Chamberlain was staring out of the window. He looked at Leggett. His earlier good spirits seemed to have left him, or perhaps, thought Leggett, they had only ever been a show for the crowds and the cameras.
"Thank you," he said. "I suppose we'd better make a start."
Wilson said,
"Why don't you have some breakfast first, PM? Hugh, would you mind asking the pilot?"
Leggett put his head into the cockpit.
"Sorry to bother you, but where might I find some food?" "There's a locker at the back, sir."
Leggett lingered for a moment, briefly mesmerized once more by the sight of the clouds through the windscreen, then turned back to the cabin. Strang, Malkin, Ashton Watkin, even Dunglass, now they all looked pensive. In the rear of the plane he found the locker. Two wicker hampers, stenciled with the name of the Savoy Hotel, were crammed full of neatly wrapped and labelled packages. Grouse and smoked salmon sandwiches, patty and caviar, bottles of claret and beer and cider, flasks of tea and coffee. It seemed an inappropriate feast, a picnic for a day at the races. He carried the hampers to the empty seats in the middle of the plane. Dunglass got up to help him distribute it all. The Prime Minister took a cup of tea and refused everything else. He sat very upright, holding his saucer in his left hand, his little finger crooked primly as he sipped. Leggett retreated to his seat with coffee and a smoked salmon sandwich. After a while, Strang went past him to the toilet cubicle. He stopped on his way back, buttoning his flies.
"Everything all right?"
The head of the central department was another official who had gone through the war and had retained the habit of talking to his subordinates as if he were inspecting their trench.
"Yes, thank you, sir." "The condemned men ate a hearty breakfast?"
He folded his tall frame into the seat beside Leggett's. He was in his mid-40s, but looked 60. His suit exuded a faint aroma of pipe tobacco.
"Do you realize you're the only man on this plane who speaks German?"
"I hadn't thought of that, sir." Strang gazed out of the window.
"Let's hope this landing's better than the last one. There was a rainstorm over Munich. The pilot couldn't see a thing. We ended up being thrown around all over the place. The only person who didn't seem to mind was the PM.
He's quite a cool customer,
isn't he? One never really knows what's going through his mind."
He leaned across the aisle and spoke more quietly.
"I just wanted to give you a gentle warning, Hugh. You haven't been through this before. There's a chance this whole thing could turn out to be a fiasco. We have no agreed agenda, no preliminary work has been done, there are no official papers. If it breaks down and Hitler grabs the chance to invade Czechoslovakia after all, we could be in the ludicrous position of having the leaders of Britain and France both stranded in Germany on the outbreak of war. Surely that's not likely. I was with the PM in Bad Godesberg. We thought we had an agreement then, until Hitler suddenly came up with a new set of demands. It's not like dealing with a normal head of government. He's more like some barbarian chieftain out of a Germanic legend. A Manorik, Theodoric, with his housecarls gathered around him. They leap up when he comes in, and he freezes them with a look, asserts his authority, and then he settles down at a long table to feast with them and to laugh and boast. Who'd want to be in the PM's shoes trying to negotiate with such a creature?"
The pilot appeared in the doorway of the cockpit.
"Gentlemen, just to let you know, we have crossed the English Channel."
The Prime Minister glanced down the plane and gestured to Leggett.
"I think we'd better start work on those boxes now."
Chapter 3 The Führer's train was slowing. After more than 12 hours of relentless forward motion, Hartmann could detect a slight but definite swaying back and forth as the driver applied the brakes. They were in the hilly country an hour south of Munich, not far from where he had gone walking with Hugh and Lena in the summer of 1932. Beyond the windows the woodland had begun to thin, A river glinted silver through the trees, and then an ancient town curved into view on the opposite bank. Gaily painted houses, pale blue, lime green, canary yellow, fronted onto the water. Behind them, a grey stone medieval castle sprawled across a wooded hill,